From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. A few months ago, we spent a week exploring the question, who controls the news? We had conversations on media ownership in the era of private equity, the rise of nonprofit news sources, and a new state government task force aimed at boosting local journalism. Plus, we heard an Illinois professor's argument that news is increasingly geared toward people who are rich, white, and blue, in the sense of leaning Democratic. Today on the program, we're revisiting our conversation with journalists looking to inform Black and Latino readers, two groups that were historically not well-served by mainstream coverage. That conversation is later this hour. But we're beginning with a talk that was more personal to me, in which we asked the question, what is lost when a community loses its newspaper, or at least sees that paper shrunk to a vestige of its former self? Some version of the State Journal Register has been published in Springfield and Sangamon County since 1831. It shared stories of fistfights in the old state capitol and reported on an ambitious local attorney named Abraham Lincoln. In more recent years, the paper was a finalist for a Pulitzer, having crossed borders to explore how immigrants from Mexico transformed Beardstown in central Illinois, which had been all white. Today, however, the State Journal Register is not what it once was. Back in 2007, the Copley family, which had owned the SJR for generations, sold to a private equity-backed firm called Gatehouse. And that's when the cutting began. I recently reviewed an internal phone directory from 1999 and counted 70 people. These were reporters, columnists, editors, photographers, a cartoonist, designers, copy editors, librarians, clerks, and other support personnel. But by the time we first broadcast this conversation, back in the fall, the number of full-time newsroom employees at the SJR had gone from 70 to 9, plus two part-timers. If the SJR were an NFL team, it would be like trying to play a football game, offense, defense, special teams, backup, with just six people. Good luck. For our first conversation today, we tried to understand what that cutting, what that loss, means for a community like Springfield. I'll give the same preface I gave when we first aired this. I am not objective in this story because I once worked at the State Journal Register, covering the arts and entertainment beat. You can count me among the tens of thousands of people who were working at newspapers a decade ago, but are not today. That also describes the two guests who joined us in October to talk about this. Mike Kinsler, who worked at the SJR for nearly 40 years, including stints covering City Hall, as State House Bureau Chief and as Metro Editor, the person responsible for overseeing local news coverage. And Rich Saul, who was a photographer at the paper for 35 years, including nearly two decades as photo editor. I'll also repeat the other caveat I gave when we originally had this conversation. It's a conversation that was more in sorrow than in anger. I want to be clear that I do not hold the current reporters and editors at the SJR responsible for any of this. The decisions were made by out-of-town executives in the years before the current editor arrived. And the people that remain are doing the best they can to cover the city, the region, and the state house under difficult circumstances. Since this conversation is on tape, we're not taking any calls, but we do still want to hear from you. You can always let us know what you thought by tweeting at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. I started the conversation by asking Mike what his job was like while the paper was at full strength, 70 people in the newsroom.
Well, you couldn't go into the day with goals, in a sense, because you didn't know what the news was going to happen. I do remember an awful lot of the time I'd be driving in from home and thinking, you know, I know there's going to be stuff happening today, and I feel really confident that we can deal with it, that we had the people we needed. We had people we could set aside to work on long-term projects, but at the same time, we were going to be able to cover breaking news, whatever happened, whenever it happened. You know, it was just a nice, solid feeling to know you're going to be dealing with a couple of dozen, in my case, a news reporter, pro news reporters, who you could turn to in almost any situation, and you would produce something that gave a sense of the community you lived in.
Rich, what about you? What was the photography department doing on a daily basis 20 years ago?
Well, similar to what Mike mentioned, my interest was, of course, having the photographs that accompanied stories, but also, we were interested in the things that were happening that might not have merited a news story, but you know, might have been a simple, what we call a standalone feature picture. You know, they didn't have to be weighty news issues, but it was a way for our readers to see what we saw, see what was going on in town, whether it was an event or not an event, but just an interesting image. The term that my former boss editor Barry Locker used to use was storytelling visual journalism. And so, you know, what we did compared to what news reporters did was very similar. It was just a different approach to how we told that story.
Mike, maybe we can talk about some of the special projects the paper could take on back then. I remember a book that was made out of a series on campaign finance. I mentioned the Beardstown story involving what was then the newspaper owner, Copley's Mexico City bureau chief, Lynn Walker. She was a Pulitzer finalist for that. How did that come about?
You know, I don't know whose idea it was. It might have been Barry Locker's, but obviously we'd been keeping an eye on the fact that Beardstown had a growing Hispanic population. They were moving there to work in the meatpacking industry, because they were willing to do jobs that Anglos were not at that time willing to take on. And as that population grew, it became obvious that we were missing the boat if we didn't explain what was happening in and around Beardstown, both from the point of view of the immigrants, but also from the people who had lived there in many cases for decades, for more than a century, some of them, I suppose, what the interactions were like and what changes that had brought on. And Lynn Walker, of course, who knew Spanish very well, was able to come in and do that in a way that we didn't have anybody on our local staff to do. One of the great things about being part of the Copley organization was you had that kind of backup for stories that went beyond your home base. They had a Washington bureau, they had a one-person Chicago bureau. The San Diego paper, of course, was the flagship paper, had a lot of people, and Lynn did most of her work with the San Diego paper because it obviously had a lot of connections in Mexico City. But she was available and interested and willing and eager to take on a look at a Spanish Hispanic community that had just popped up almost out of nowhere and transformed Beardstown, which had been dying slowly, and suddenly Hispanics came in, and it was essentially a boom town. The immigration did what immigration has done throughout the history of the United States and reinvigorated areas.
Yeah.
Reinvigorated Beardstown. The one regret I have about that series, it was an idea I got way too late in the process to carry it out, is we should have printed a limited edition of it in Spanish for the people we were writing about. That was a shame.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And actually, it brings me to another thing that I was thinking about in terms of limited edition, extra editions. We recently marked 20 years since the 9/11 attacks. You were posting on Facebook recently. You think that was probably the last ever extra edition that the SJR published was on September 11th, 2001.
Well, it will be the last ever. Yeah. We don't have a press in Springfield anymore. There's no way to get, even if we wanted to try and pull it off, they wanted to try and pull it off. You could had to bring the print newspapers down from Peoria, and by the time they got here, it'd be a waste of time. But yes, the news broke obviously early in the morning. We were scrambling to keep up with it just from afar when Jeff Nelson, who was the editor of our sister paper in Lincoln, Illinois, he'd worked in Springfield before, called me up and said, you know, you guys ought to do an extra. And I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. And almost moments later, the publisher, Pat Coburn, came by the city desk. And Pat, excuse me, my Alexa machine just went off for no reason.
It's all right. Modern life. Pat, yeah. You were saying Pat Coburn came
Pat,
by
Pat Coburn
desk.
Came by my desk. And I said, you know, we should do an extra. And he said, that's a good idea. And just somehow from about, 10:30 in the morning until a little afternoon, I think, we were able to put out four pages about the terror attacks, two pages full of local news, local photographs, and two pages of wire stuff. And the editor and the managing editor, Barry Locker, and Robert Pope, stood outside the newspaper office, the former newspaper office, the now auction newspaper office, and sold those papers on the street to drivers as they pulled up. And, you know, it was a stream of cars, one after another, that we sold out in a heartbeat, because people, once again, I mean, we're looking to the local newspaper to help them make some sense out of this senseless incident. And that's what newspapers could do in those days. It's only 20 years ago, but those days, I mean, it sounds like
those days. Yeah. Well, I mean, things have changed a lot, right? Where there's before smartphones, it was before we all had the internet in our pockets all the time. I do want to mention, we got a call, didn't want to go on air, but Eileen called in from Peoria, said used to work at the Peoria Journal Star. Same thing is happening there. She retired in 2006 before the cuts. And that, you know, that's a story we've seen in many of the communities where Gatehouse has bought papers. Galesburg is another one. Lincoln, as you mentioned, Mike, Springfield, Rockford now. We also got a text from one of our listeners. Katie in Monmouth says, when the Monmouth Daily Review Atlas was purchased by Gatehouse Media, they just stopped delivering the paper to my house. And throughout the whole time I was calling them, they never once said they weren't doing deliveries anymore. I eventually gave up. I'm a millennial, but I liked getting a physical copy of my small town paper. It's easier for me to focus with the newsprint in my hands. I can't help thinking Gatehouse's bulk purchase of papers was bundled, and somehow they are intentionally undermining the small town ones so they can claim they didn't have enough subscribership and shutter them, allowing them to focus on the bigger papers they got seemed more profitable. So now I just stream my local NPR affiliate when I get up in the morning, and if something is new in town, I just kind of trip over it. So, Rich, I mean, that's, if something is new in town, I just kind of trip over it. And that's where I wanted to talk with you about sort of you pointed out an article on Twitter recently that sort of looked at an Iowa newspaper and what happened to a newspaper there when Gannett, which is the company formerly known as Gatehouse, came to town. And it's the same company that presided over the cuts at the SJR. What drew you to that story? What parallels did you see there?
Well, there were... The story you mentioned, are mentioning, Brian, was written by Elaine Godfrey, and it uses the story of the, I believe it's the Daily Hawkeye in Burlington, Iowa, I think. And she talks about the loss, the diminishing presence of the local community newspaper, especially in a small community like Burlington, Iowa, and how many questions go unasked and go unanswered because there's no longer the staff that could cover a lot of the local goings on in a small community that people look at those papers for. And I could relate to it all personally because being at the paper for as many years as I was, I saw lots of changes after the purchase of our paper of the State Journal Register by Gatehouse. And, you know, we started to lose people. Some left on their own accord, others, and then their position was not filled. So the staff began to decrease in size. And what we lost were the unique local voices, columnists, people like Dave Bakke or Jim Rupert in the sports department who wrote about the local sports scene, excuse me. And, you know, we lost a person dedicated to covering the local food scene. You know, we had a food page. We lost people that covered the arts and entertainment beat, Brian, like you mentioned. And, you know, those things, as they began to disappear, you know, it was less comprehensive coverage of the town. And my fear is, from a historical perspective, is years from now, 5 years from now, 10, 50 or 100 years from now, when a historian or just someone interested in history or what happened in our community, Springfield, Illinois, in 2021, they'll have fewer resources to reference because there'll be less of that historical record created by the daily newspaper now, you know, the staff being just a sliver of what it used to be once upon a time. And I think that's a real loss for a community. I think it's something that most readers don't appreciate, or at least a lot of readers don't appreciate, the long-term effects you know, and because these cuts have come gradually, they might not even realize how many things they have lost.
Okay, I need to interrupt. My guests are Rich Saul, the former photo editor of the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield, and Mike Kinsler, former Metro editor, among other roles at the SJR. And we're listening back to a conversation I had with them a few months ago as part of our Who Controls the News week. We're revisiting a number of those conversations all this week on the program. We're going to continue this talk after a short break. Then we're going to be speaking with people who are focused on trying to bring news to Black and Latino audiences in Illinois who have traditionally been underserved by mainstream media. That's all coming up after a short break. Before we take a break, I want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can let us know what you thought about our conversations on the program. Send us an email, leave us a voicemail. You can also sign up for our podcast. Again, everything is on 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us.